Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, we have an open line for you at 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our calls, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, we're going to talk about popular kids versus unpopular kids. Who earns more and who is happier in life? Some very interesting research about this. And pork, is it really contaminated, as Consumer Reports says, or is it not contaminated, as the USDA says? We'll talk about food safety.
Mm-hmm. And what's our recipe?
Angel Food Cake Tiramisu. You will love this recipe. It is a yummy dessert recipe.
Coming up in a while. Let's welcome our first caller now, Zorba, a listener with us in Mazamani, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Tom, Dr. Zorba.
How can we help?
Well, I have a little bump on my shin bone, at the top of the shin bone, that has been there for about 4 months after I took a fall. And I just am wondering whether to be concerned about it or not.
Does it hurt?
It doesn't hurt when I press on it. But the only time that I notice it really is when I go to squat down so that there's pressure on that joint or that bone, and it feels kind of stiff and a little bit sore.
Is it a hard thing, or can you squish it with your hand?
No, it's almost like a bone bump, and it's about the size of a malted milk ball.
Okay.
But I hit it pretty hard, and when I did fall, there was a kind of a blood blister that emerged, and it was dark, and it took about a month to go away.
Got you. So you had a good amount of trauma to your knee. You know, one of those things, I'll tell you what usually is. First of all, it is painful, a little painful, not painful. How would you describe it?
Oh, at first it was very painful, and I kind of hobbled down the trail back to the car and babied it for, you know, I guess a week or so.
And now?
Now, again, I don't notice it except when I go to squat down. And
gotcha.
Then it's
just
yep,
with it. Yeah, it sounds to me as if what happened is you've got a little blood clot beneath the skin that won't ever travel. People always worry about clots and if they're going to travel, but this type of clot does not. And sometimes the body does something called organizing, which means that it will take the clot and almost make it into a permanent scar. They do tend to shrink over time. If they're very bothersome, sometimes we actually open them up and take them out, but that's what it sounds like. It certainly could be a broken bone. Pretty unlikely that it's a broken bone. You know, the shin bone is pretty strong and it rarely breaks, but you know, if it were a broken bone, it probably would have been so painful that you wouldn't have been able to walk. So most likely it's, as I said, it's this little scar. And if it were me, I would not have it taken out unless it bothers you a lot. And then I would still wait for probably longer, up to a year, because sometimes these things resolve on their own.
Okay. Thank you so much. That kind of assuages my fears.
Ah, if we can get rid of fears, then we have done our job today.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
We appreciate the call at 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, a listener with us in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
I have a concern with the bottom of my left heel. I'm a trim carpenter, and I do stairs are my specialty, so I'm up and down all the time, but I seem to have bumped it on the very bottom of the heel, and it's like a bruise, except for you can't see anything, but it's actually very painful to walk on. When I'm sitting relaxing, it doesn't hurt, but as soon as I get up for the first 6 or 8 steps, oh, boy, I'm really hobbled, and I was just wondering what that could be.
Yeah.
And it's been quite a long time.
So quite a long time, meaning how long?
About 6 months.
6 months. I would definitely say that's quite a long time. Now, you are a trim carpenter. Now, not being a carpenter, I don't know actually exactly what that means, and your specialty is stairs, so why don't you tell me what you do on your job?
Actually, I do interior trim, and where I set cabinetry, but also my specialty are to do curved stairways where they have the handrails, the elaborate Gone with the Wind type handrails are my specialty.
Got you. Very, very interesting. How'd you get into that job?
I'm third generation, and I've been doing it for 42 years.
Wow, that is quite something. Okay, so now that you've now given me an education on trim carpentry, getting back to the issue, do you walk around barefoot around the house?
I do quite often, the house is mostly carpet.
Wait a second. You're a trim carpenter, and your house is carpet. Okay, I just want to get that straight. Quite often, we have bursa on the bottom of our feet. These are little fat pads, and they pad us. I mean, that's what they do. They pad between the muscle and the bone, and they'll pad between bone and bone. And quite often, what we'll do is we'll overuse it, and there'll be a little micro break, a little blood vessel that breaks underneath there, and that can then be quite painful, quite unusual. And for some people, it can produce something called plantar fasciitis, which is pain in the ligaments in the bottom of the foot. And for other people, it's just this bursitis that occurs there. And one of the things to do is to not stop walking barefoot around the house. That's a biggie. It really is important. And I tell people, do not wear a regular house slipper. They are worthless. Either wear something such as Crocs that has a little bit of give to it, wear a really good sandal like a Teva sandal, or wear something such as an athletic shoe so it's got a little bit of give. What you want is support in that area, but you don't want to have it flat. And that would be my first recommendation. So I go right to that. The second thing I would do is I would take a good anti-inflammatory for 2 to 4 weeks to try to just get it to settle down. And that would mean 2 over-the-counter Aleve tablets, generic are just as good as the name brand, 2 Aleve tablets twice a day. That's 440 milligrams because they only come in a 220 dose. And I would take that twice a day. So I do the anti-inflammatories, number one. Number two, I would wear the shoes. And the third thing I would do is there are stretching exercises that you can do for the plantar fascia, for the bottom of the foot and for the heel, that will really make a difference. And we'll put that on our website. If you go to zorbapastor.org, we'll put stretching exercises for your foot and ankle on our website so you'll be able to get them there.
Okay. Well, that sounds wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're most welcome.
Thank you.
You're
we appreciate welcome. The call. Before our next call, Zorba. Popular kids earn more than nerds, it says here.
Yes, yes. This is part of the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study, our state. And they looked at 10,000 men and women who graduated from Wisconsin high schools back in 1957. Do you remember 1957, Tom?
I'm not old enough to remember 1957.
No, you're old enough to forget 1957 is what it actually is. It's at the opposite. So each of the students were asked to list 3 people who they considered to be their closest friends. And they wrote these names down. Now, five decades later, they looked back to see what they could understand about popularity. And it was quite interesting. It turned out that the smarter kids were the ones who tended to be more popular. They weren't the kids who were necessarily the beautiful and the handsome kids. And then they looked back and found out from the data that they had that the popular kids tend to come from warm family environments. And contrary to any nerd stereotypes, the students who were smarter and also older tended to actually receive more friendship listings than younger, less intelligent peers.
Okay.
So in other words, you automatically assume the most popular kids are the most handsome kids, or the most beautiful kids.
But not necessarily so.
And they basically found that when students were in the more popular category and they looked at what they did in their life and how much money they made and whether they were happy with their career, the ones who were the most popular did better. And so that makes a huge difference. It shows that popularity might actually be a marker for warm families that actually produce a nurturing environment. And the nurturing environment is actually what leads to success.
Yeah. But it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that it also shows that popular kids are pretty good at not only making friends, but probably impressing professors in college, getting better jobs because they're better at presenting themselves to employers.
Right. Oh, no, that's exactly it. The popular kids are more likely to have more opportunities because they are actually the ones who are more charismatic, if you will.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you something quite interesting. I have four children, wonderful children. They're perfect children. I was the perfect parent. Penny was the perfect parent.
True. And it's true.
Yeah, we were good. You know, good is as good as you get.
Yeah.
But I have four kids. Now, my oldest son, Zach, is it just is more endearing. They're all endearing. He's more endearing. Mm-hmm. And whenever my friends come in, they'll say, because my kids are all older now, they'll say, how are the kids? They always also say, how's Zach doing? Now, it's quite interesting because some of them only saw him when he was like 5 or 6 or 7 or 8. And there was something about that that impressed them. You know,
He's a charismatic kid.
He is more charismatic and so he is outrageously satisfied with what he's doing. In other words, he says, I have a great job, love what I'm doing, love where I'm working. And it's quite interesting because that all comes around together in that the connectiveness makes a huge difference in terms of
this
success.
This goes along with my theory of how we elect presidents. We always elect, never mind ideology, never mind any of the issues, we always elect the least dull candidate.
The least
Obama's
dull
not as dull as Romney.
That's
go
right.
all the way back.
That's right.
Who do you want to pick? Kennedy, Nixon?
That's right.
Eisenhower,
that's right.
Stevenson?
That's right. That's right.
Bush, Gore,
that's
Bush,
right.
Kerry?
That's right.
They're about
that's
even.
Right.
They're both
about
fairly
that's
dull,
right. that's
but
right.
the elections
yes,
were
that's
even.
Right. Yeah, that's
so
right.
I think you can take this back. Roosevelt?
That's right.
All the, yeah.
that's right. The least dull candidate is the one that we elect. I love it. We now have Tom's method of electing presidents, and you know what? I'll bet on that during the next election.
800-462-7413. Toll-free 800-462-7413. To the phones again, Zorba, with a listener in Augusta, Georgia now. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Okay, about a month and a half ago, I did something to my Achilles, and I'm just not sure how serious it is because I haven't been able to run since then. I mean, I'm able to do walking and I've been doing lifting still, but I'm wondering if it's more serious, if it could be a heel spur, or if there's anything I can do other than just what I've been doing and taking a leave and doing some calf stretches and icing it once in a while.
How much running do you do?
Well, pre-injury, I was doing about 40 miles a week.
Wow. 40 miles a week? This is not a this is not
I've
a casual
really
run.
I'm serious in training.
Have you done anything for this? Seen a physical therapist or anybody?
I have, and she had me do a whole bunch of exercises, and she was feeling around, and she was looking for something to be, you know, feel painful, but none of it really hurt what she was having me do. And they took an x-ray, and they didn't see any bone spurs, which is what I was, like, fearful of. But she wanted me to come back and pay for some really expensive physical therapy, and I was just, I wasn't sure if that was worth it, and I was just hoping maybe there's something I could do on my own at home.
How long has this been going on for?
About a month and a half, and I haven't ran since then. I tried because about a month into it, I felt so cooped up, and I just wanted to go for a little run.
Sure.
And it was so nice out, and I got like 30 seconds into it, and I was in so much pain.
Wow.
I had to stop.
How awful is that? Here it is. You love running. You're doing 40 miles a week, which is a lot of miles, and all of a sudden you can't even go down the block without getting pain and discomfort. That has to be very discouraging. New shoes? Your shoes are good?
Well, at the time of the injury, I think I was probably past the due date of getting a new pair of shoes. So I have since gotten new shoes.
Okay. That, by the way, is very important. That is, you know, that's part of the issue. Are you wearing a heel cup? Did you put anything in your shoes at all?
No, I wasn't sure if that was worth investing in.
Well, they're not too expensive. Plastic heel cups you can pretty much pick up in many, many different places, in athletic stores, in good pharmacies. They're heel gel pads, which are very inexpensive. The plastic heel cups sometimes are actually a little bit better. Not walking around barefoot, very, very important for that. Stretching exercises, like you said, physical therapy may be too expensive. I highly recommend that you look at heel stretching exercises. You go to YouTube and you will find a good number of physical therapists who have videoed themselves doing a whole bunch of different stretching exercises for the heel. And then if you're good at looking at something like that, you can do that on your own. And once again, do you walk barefoot around your house?
I do.
You know, all these, you know, everyone I look... Barefoot, 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 that disturbs things. What you want to do, as close to zero amount of time barefoot and in your socks that you can do, is the way it is. Crocs, another older athletic shoe that's got at least a good firm insole, very, very important. That makes a big difference. And then anti-inflammatories, as I always tell people, 4 to 6 weeks, over-the-counter relief, 2 tablets twice a day, stretching exercises, and stop walking barefoot around the house.
Okay.
Don't some good runners run barefoot?
Mm-hmm. Well, the answer is yes. Yeah. I mean, some good runners do run barefoot, but some runners don't run barefoot. And some people can ride horses bareback, and other people mm-hmm. need a saddle, and some people need a boot, and some people like a shoe. You know, you've got to look at what your body, what your strong suit and weak suit is. It's mm-hmm. very clear to me that you need padding underneath your foot in the form, as I said, all these things, including a heel cup, and that's what I would do. And I would stay away from minimalist running at this point. Now, in the future, if this settles down, you could see whether or not it works for you, but minimalist running is not for everybody.
All right, well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the call. And before we take a short break, Zorba, time for you to grab your gavel for another jarring episode of Judge Zorba.
Okay, now I've got a gavel which looks like it should be expensive, but I actually think is plastic. It's from the Royal Neighbors of America, and it caused me the oracle. In 1977, someone became the oracle of the Royal Neighbors of America. And you know what this means? It means this gavel has the weight of the future, because when I put this down and I make a decision, it's the future's decision. So I just want to tell you, the gavel is magic.
Okay. Today's case comes to us from Arthur in Tennessee, who wants to know if heat could be harming his health. Now, Arthur is 91 years old and served in World War II. Ever since his days in the Army, he's always been cold. Now, he sets his thermostat to a balmy 80 degrees, but a friend warned him that this will shorten his life. So Arthur wants to know, should he be wary of warmth? I love it. This 91-year-old guy is afraid that 80 degrees will shorten his life. I think he's okay. What do you think?
I think he's okay, too. I definitely think he's okay. That's it. He's okay. There it is. You're okay. Now, I think at 91 years of age, you can be in any type of environment you want to. I think you've earned that. And I can imagine why, after you've been in World War II, yeah. how you could just remember that cold and you don't want to go anywhere near there again. So,
makes
Arthur,
sense. Yeah.
You keep that thermostat high.
Have an argument that's been heating up. Add your case to the docket by sending it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up, then lots more of your calls, our medical myth buster too. Lots of great reasons for you to stay with us here on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before we get back to the phones, the recipe is angel food cake tiramisu.
Now, do you like tiramisu?
Yes.
I happen to like tiramisu.
Yes.
And one of the things that I like about this recipe is that it's from our producer, Gabby. Our new producer, Gabby. And she has done what she calls a healthified recipe from what her mother makes. So, you know, I kind of like it's a traditional recipe, it must be, in her family.
Yeah, it's nice to have a producer that can do double duty.
Absolutely. As a chef, as a producer par excellence, and to make those wonderful recipes just healthier that we have from our past. Okay, your mom loved to cook, didn't she, Tom?
Let's see. Meat, potato. Vegetable.
Vegetable, meat, potato.
Hey, my mom had to work.
Actually, my mom worked, and she didn't cook very much either, now that I think about it. She worked. You know, she'd walk to work and walk home from work, even in the cold weather.
Yeah.
It wasn't uphill both ways, but really, she walked. It was about a mile to work, and she didn't. We only had one car.
These are heartbreaking stories.
I'm sorry. We're getting into the heartbreak. No, I had a good life, and she had a good life. I didn't mean to.
Let's do the recipe.
That. But she's gone, so she doesn't listen to the show anymore, so I can't. Okay. So we're going to talk about how the recipe is healthified. Start out with a half cup of reduced fat cream cheese.
Half a cup reduced fat cream cheese.
Now, guess why that is healthier?
Because it's reduced fat.
Very good. Excellent.
That
you
was
are
a great
so
guy.
Good.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
are
yeah,
so good.
Yeah.
A half a cup of low fat ricotta cheese.
Half a cup. Low-fat ricotta cheese.
And guess why that's healthier?
Let's move along.
Okay. Half a cup of powdered sugar sifted.
Half a cup of powdered sugar sifted.
3 tablespoonfuls of coffee liqueur. We're talking Kahlua.
Yeah. 3 big tea coffee liqueur.
Okay. Now, this recipe is unique from recipes I make in that we're using 8 ounces of frozen non-fat whipped dairy topping, which is thought. It's often in the frozen food case.
What makes this unique?
Well, because I don't usually use whipped toppings, but but when I make recipes, you could substitute 8 ounces of whipped cream, but the problem is whipped cream doesn't have the strength to be able to hold on to it. But if you want to use 8 ounces of whipped cream and make it, you could do that in this recipe also.
Okay.
Okay. 1/4 cup of low-fat or fat-free yogurt.
1/4 cup low-fat or fat-free yogurt.
2 tablespoonfuls of coffee liqueur. Again, you're going to be using it in another part
of the recipe. 2 big tea coffee liqueur.
1 8-inch angel food cake. Okay.
An 8-inch angel food cake.
Now,
you can buy at the local grocery.
Right. Now, there are differences between angel food cake. There's good angel food cake and bad angel food cake.
How do you tell the difference?
Well, by taste, obviously, but what you want to do is buy an angel food cake that has been, if possible, more recently made, that's more locally made. It is going to taste better.
Mm-hmm.
You may want to make it yourself, but I've tried making angel food, and I've failed numerous times doing it, so I don't even try anymore.
Mm-hmm.
2 tablespoonfuls of instant espresso.
2 big tea instant espresso.
Some more coffee liqueur, a couple of other tablespoons.
It comes up every now and then.
You know, I happen to like coffee liqueur. So maybe while you're making the recipe, you put a little bit on some ice, and then you drink the coffee liqueur while you're making the recipe.
Okay.
I'm kind of getting thirsty for the coffee liqueur. 1 teaspoonful of vanilla extract.
A little tea vanilla extract.
And 2 tablespoonfuls of unsweetened baking cocoa.
2 big tea unsweetened baking cocoa.
Okay, now for the filling, in a large bowl, mix the cream cheese, ricotta, powdered sugar, and the 3 tablespoonfuls of liqueur. Beat with an electric mixer on medium heat until smooth, and then stir in 1/2 cup of whipped dessert topping, or in my case, I would stir in 1/2 cup of whipped cream and set that aside. Now, for the frosting, in a medium bowl, combine the remaining either whipped cream or whipped topping, sour cream, 2 tablespoonfuls of the coffee liqueur, and vanilla, and set that aside. Cut the angel food cake into 2 horizontal slices. Can you picture this? Cutting into two?
Yeah.
I mean, easily. Place 1 layer on the serving platter and the remaining 2 layers on a large dinner plate. Then, with a fork or skewer, poke holes in the top of all 3 layers. So you can see you're poking holes in order to get basically the liquid inside. Then in a small bowl, combine the instant espresso, 1/4 cup of water, and 2 tablespoonfuls of the liqueur, and drizzle over the 3 layers. Spread the bottom layer with half the filling. Add the middle layer, spread on the remaining filling. Add the top layer with the rest. Frost the cake with the filling and sprinkle with cocoa powder. Now, it seems complex, but it really isn't. Once you look at the recipe on our website, you'll see it's incredibly easy.
Sounds great.
It's layered and it's really good. Serve immediately or cover and chill in the refrigerator for 4 hours, which is what I will be likely to do when I make this recipe for my family because I happen to like tiramisu.
Sounds delicious. Our thanks to new producer Gabrielle Pedriani for her modified mom's recipe. Remember when former producer Adam Friedrich used to actually bring the food in?
I do. Yeah. And I wonder why new producer Gabriella has not managed to bring the food in for us to be able to taste to make sure that we actually like the food that we're eating. But this is a dynamite recipe. You'll like this. So if you want a copy of today's recipe, go to our website at zorbapastor.org. You can look at today's recipe and you can search for all your favorite Zorba Pastor On Your Health recipes. That's zorbapastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
+1 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, back to the phones. Let's welcome a listener in Schulzburg, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Tom and Dr. Zorba.
How can we help?
Well, I first would like to say that I feel very honored to be able to talk to you. I've listened to you guys for years, and I really admire you. I've listened to you guys since Shep was a pup and Moby Dick was a minnow.
Well, that's very nice, but you're giving us big heads here.
Well, I consider you just a fantastic team. I'd compare you to like Lewis and Clark.
Oh, my goodness.
Fred and Barney, or even Roy and Trigger.
Wait a minute. I resent that thing. You're calling me a horse's patoot.
The reason I'm calling is I have a 32-year-old son that is a union boilermaker. He works on these huge power plants. And about 6 months ago, he started to have all kinds of pain in one of his pinky toes. So he went to a doctor, and the doctor told him he had hammer toe. And it persisted and persisted. So we did some checking around, and we found an orthopedic surgeon in Madison, Wisconsin, and sent him to that doctor who told him he had mallet toe. And there was two options. He could have surgery on the toe and get some little rods stuck in it. And the more simpler and better thing this man recommended, this doctor, was to just remove the toe. So our quandary here is, how is this going to affect him having the toe removed as far as balance? Because it's very important in his job that he has good balance. He works lots of times way up in the air. And do you think, doctor, that simply removing the toe is, you know, end of story, best scenario?
Now, how old is your son?
He's 32.
32. Okay. And he's got pain with the hammer toe, mallet toe that he has?
Yes.
A lot of pain, little pain?
A lot of pain.
Yeah. Well, if it were me, I would not have the toe removed first. That's what I wouldn't do. What I would immediately do is I would say, even if it's a two-part procedure, I would first have the toe fixed. And if it didn't work and I continue to have pain, then I'd remove the toe. The big toe is the one that we use for balance. And the rest of the foot is, we kind of use them together as a unit. When you think about when you walk, you can sort of grab with the other 4 toes, and then the great toe, you can wiggle up and down. So the great toe is really used for balance, but I would get a second opinion. I mean, that's what I would do, no matter what, before I had either one done, because I just would be concerned. It seems to me, of course, like that is a much more invasive surgery to have the toe removed. On the other hand, he's seen things, and he's seen that these can improve. But before I had my toe removed, I'd sure get someone else to chime in there and say, what are the benefits and the risks? That's what I would do.
All right, thank you.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
I do have another suggestion in addition to that.
Okay.
What I would do is I would do a little research on PubMed, and you can go to that website. We'll put that on our website, zorbapastor.org, and that's the National Library of Medicine. And they have a number of really good articles, many of which are indexed from medical journals. But I would put in, you know, hammer toe, and I'd put in second or the number two, and I would put in the word treatment, and then I'd see what would come up, and then I'd look at some of the treatment and the research before I get that second opinion. That's exactly what I would do. So
I've made some notes, and I will do that.
Excellent. You made notes.
Oh.
People are taking note of what we say, Tom. Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Well, you guys kind of rained on my picnic here, though, by telling me all this. I mean, you know, we got an upcoming season here of Christmas, and I found my old potato cannon, and I thought he could bring that toe home, and for once in our lives, we could have a real mistletoe.
Thanks for the call anyway.
All right. Okay, keep up the good work, guys, and we'll keep listening.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
A real mistletoe.
800-462-7413. Three. On we go to Pocatello, Idaho now. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I'm at the age now where I guess I should be considering the shingles vaccine, but I don't have a spleen, and there were some concerns about a compromised immune system and complications from getting the vaccine. I've been very active, healthy, athletic all my life, and heard from some people even younger than me that they've had the shingles and it was really, really uncomfortable. So I'm just looking for some guidance about whether it makes sense for me to get that and what the risks and benefits would
be. Oh, sure. Now, having your spleen removed puts you at risk for certain diseases such as strep. That's a good example, pneumococcus. You don't have your spleen. But you don't have a compromised immune system. You just don't have your spleen. So people with a compromised immune system, for instance, would be people with HIV/AIDS, people who are on chemotherapy because they have a compromised immune system, and people with a variety of other medical conditions can produce that. You don't have that. You have a very specific condition, which is no spleen. It's splenia. It's not there at all. The shingles infection is already in your body. In other words, you had chicken pox when you were younger. Assuming that, that is the shingles virus, is the chicken pox virus, and it just sits there dormant, waiting, waiting, waiting to open the door and explode into the system. And it happens with some people. It's, you know, almost an Edgar Allan Poe story. So the way to do it is to call up your doc, because I don't have this information, and say, is there any contraindication for people who do not have their spleen? Now, let's say your doc doesn't know. Well, then you look in the package insert for the vaccine and say, is there a risk with somebody who had their spleen removed? If they don't find a risk specifically cited for those who have not had their spleen removed, then to me, the risk is very minimal. But this is a good example where I would double check before I had it done. In other words, I'd look either at the package insert, call my local ID doc about it, or I would ask my pharmacist and say, is there any contradiction for anyone who has lost their spleen? And then if there's no problem with that, then I would definitely have it done. But I wanted to sort of teach you how I would go through making the decision, which is finding the data.
Right. Great. Yeah, I like the pharmacy lead there, and I'll check that out as well.
Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. He mentioned getting to the age when he might need the vaccine.
Yes.
What age is that?
Well, the age for the vaccine, first of all, the shingles vaccine is certainly recommended for people over the 65 and older. But that number has been dropped down. I think the number is now 60 where it's now recommended. It's also recommended in other special populations. So this is the age, like you said. You know, I don't know its exact age.
I got the vaccine when it costs, I think, $400 or something. Now it's a lot cheaper than that.
Did you have to pay for the vaccine?
I did, out of my own pocket.
Oh, it's terrible.
That's before my insurance covered it.
That was before I had seen before your insurance covered it. I've got it. Thank you, Tom.
800-462-7413. Zorba, before we take a short break, Let's start the clock for another heart-racing round of rapid fire. Are you ready?
I am ready.
First up, Garland in Wakefield, Michigan wants to know if canned beans are nutritionally different from dried.
Canned beans are about the same as dried beans. They will both give you the same nutrition, and they will both give you gas.
Uh-huh. Okay, now into Ed, who's in search of a solution to his wife's seasonal depression. Any suggestions?
Yes, get an SAD Lite, a seasonal affective disorder light. I recommend buying it on Amazon.com. They cost about $60, and they work.
Let's head over to Harry now, who wants to know if there's a cure for eczema.
Eczema. There is no cure for eczema, but there is a treatment for eczema, and the treatment are creams and lotions, often steroid creams and non-steroid creams, and the old standby tar. Now, I don't mean the tar that you put on the driveway or on the sidewalk, but I mean coal tar that's actually in a cream form that has been effective for thousands of years.
Everett in Hilliard, Florida wants to know, do MRIs have the same radiation risks as X-rays?
MRIs do not have any radiation. MRI stands for magnetic resonance imaging.
Next up is Rebecca from Livingston, Montana, who wants to know about GMOs. What's your take on genetically modified organisms?
Well, I don't think they're really frankenfoods, as a lot of people believe. I think that if the feds think they're safe, they probably are. Hybridization has been working for years. That's why the strawberries I buy in the store are plumper than ever, and I can finally have watermelons without spitting out the seeds.
Grand finale time. Some coffee confusion here. You sometimes say coffee is healthy, but Gary wants to know, does instant coffee have the same benefits as brewed?
Of course it does. There's only one problem. It tastes yucky.
There's an argument there, but I won't get into it right now. Zorba, time to sit back and relax now. That's it for this week's edition of Rapid Fire, but make sure to fire off a bullet in our next round of fun. Just send your question along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some interesting research to talk over, lots more of your calls, of course, at our Medical Myth Buster, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But before we get back to the phones, Zorba, a study finding that most pork is contaminated with something called Yersinia bacteria?
Well, Yersinia is a bacteria that is associated with diarrhea, often bloody diarrhea, cramps, fever. When you get it, it can really be a very, you know, serious infection.
Yeah.
And this was actually an article. It was a study that came out of Consumer Reports. And Consumer Reports, I think, does fine research. And it's quite interesting because they differ in this particular case with the USDA. But they took samples from supermarkets across the country. They took samples of 148 pork chops and 50 ground pork samples. And I mean, there really are differences here, but they took all of them, lumped them together, and lo and behold, 69% tested positive for Yersinia, 11% for E. coli, Enterococcus, and then also Salmonella and Listeria and others. And these can be serious infectious problems. There were more found in the ground pork samples than in the pork chops, because the pork chop, it's the outside of the chop that would get it, not the chop itself. You know what I mean?
No, I do. I do know what you mean.
Whereas when you're talking about ground pork, it's all mixed together.
Yeah, but if this is in most pork, mostly ground, but even pork chops,
right,
then
you want to wonder about it. So the U.S. Department of Agriculture looked at this and they said, phooey, we don't think this is the case. We don't believe your work. We affirm the companies are meeting the established standards for public health, and we don't believe what you found. Well, it's interesting because I think the USDA is really pretty good too, and you know, I think Consumer Reports are good too. Now, the answer, of course, is to make sure that you cook your pork to the temperature that's correct, which should be about 145 to 160 degrees.
Yeah, I've got two quick things. I didn't know that Consumer Reports did food things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do.
I tried to picture the USDA saying fooey.
Well, they didn't exactly say fooey, but they said the equivalent of fooey. So follow things, cook the chops to 145 degrees, ground pork to 160 degrees, and you will be safe.
1-800-462-7413. It's toll-free, of course. 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, back to the phones. A listener with us in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help?
Ever since I was a little kid, I've had these occasions where I laugh uncontrollably at something, and I roll around the floor. My stomach hurts. I can't stop laughing. Something I call laughing fit. Hmm. And I find that a lot of people have had this. And my question is, how common are these laughing fits, and are they harmful to your health?
You're having these now, are you?
Oh, just, you know, once every year or two.
Yeah, and it really does double you up and really rolling on the floor?
And no matter what I do, I can't stop laughing.
Well, how funny does it have to be before this happens to you?
I don't think it has to be especially funny. It's just, somehow it tickled my fancy. I remember when I was a little kid, my brother and I would make jokes with each other when we'd both fall over laughing and roll around on the floor laughing.
Wow. You see that in, you know, comedies and cartoons and things. I just never realized that actually.
Right, I mean, I do remember laughing and I can't stop, but that's like 30 seconds
or a minute. And you're not rolling on the floor.
I am not rolling on the floor. I have never had a time where I've actually rolled on the floor because I couldn't stand up because I was laughing so hard. So your brother, does he have the same problems? Does he laugh so hard?
I don't know if he's done it in a number of years, but we did when we were kids.
Uh-huh. So, and it doesn't have to be particularly funny to make you laugh. I don't want to have you cause a fit, so I'm not going to give any jokes here while we're talking.
No, it has to be funny, but it's idiosyncratic.
Idiosyncratic.
Sometimes it just happens.
Uh-huh. So what do you do about it? Do you try not to laugh and you look at the serious side of life, or how do you keep from laughing because you don't want to have a fit?
Well, eventually it stops, and sometimes it's just brief, you know, but usually my friends, when they see me laugh like that, they're trying to make me laugh more.
That's good.
In other words, let's get him to laugh so he's rolling on the floor. I certainly could see that when you were, like, in middle school. Let's get him to laugh so we can get him to roll on the floor. But that's nice, though. People come up to you and they tell you jokes all the time. They want to get you to smile, right?
Yep.
You know, over the years, I have had a variety of calls. And whenever I travel, and I lecture quite a bit, people always come up to me and they say, what is the most unusual call you've ever received? Yeah. And usually, I've trouble remembering them, but I can remember some in immediate or distant past that I find unusual. But this takes the cake. And I don't mean to make you laugh because I don't want you to drop the phone, but this is the most unusual call I have ever had.
But this is no harm done, right? I mean,
I don't think there's no harm done. What are we going to do? You know, we could stop it by giving him a tranquilizer that he would have to take for the rest of his life. We could give him an antidepressant to dull his emotion, or we could go whole hog and give him a frontal lobotomy so he won't notice anything at all. But on the whole, no, it's not causing any problem. And I have a question for you. What do you do for a living?
I'm retired.
What did you do for a living when you were working?
I was a cook.
You were a cook. Oh. So do you still like to cook?
Oh, yeah. I like your cookbooks.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. You're just trying to see. So you like to make people happy. You were a cook. Cooks bring food people smile.
Sometimes we try to be funny here. Have we ever gotten you down on the floor rolling in laughter?
Pretty close, you guys. I laugh more at your show than just about any other one.
Well, close. We'll take close.
Well, thank you so much for your call. And now whenever I travel and people say, what was the most unusual call you ever had, I'll think of you. Thank you.
All right. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, thanks a lot. 800-462-7413. Time now, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. You know the rumor that it's lucky to make a wish when the clock strikes 11:11?
Mm-hmm.
Well, some folks are second-guessing that strategy. The latest news is that we're more likely to die at 11 a.m. than any other time of day. Is this true?
Well, we're more likely to have heart attacks in the morning. And that's been known for a long time. So first of all, we know that 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock in the morning, which is when most people wake up, you're more likely to die. Waking up seems to be the issue, starting from sort of zero when you're in a deep sleep, getting your body going.
Yeah, definitely, but that's not 11 o'clock.
Not, well, for some people it is, but yeah. For most people it's not. But there are some people who believe that 11 o'clock tends to be worse than others. I personally think that's a myth. I don't think that the hard science evidence is really there to say
there
that 11
soft
o'clock.
Science evidence?
Well, there's a lot of soft science. When you're older, well, first of all, when you're older, you're more likely to die, of course.
Yeah.
But when you're older, there's evidence there. There's like, a 1 in 8 chance you're more likely to die on your birthday or within a week of your birthday. We know that in some parts of the country, people are more likely to die after they get their paycheck. Well, do they die because they're happy after they get their paycheck?
Because they're so mad that it's another one of those.
They're mad. It's another one of those lousy paychecks. But I think that a lot of people who are sick and dying, if they're around their birthday, they actually stay around longer to be able to see one more birthday, and then they die. Yeah. I mean, I think that's been shown time and time again. And I think you're more likely to die between 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock in the morning. So my recommendation is either wake up in the morning before 6 or wake up after 9, and you'll live forever.
Yeah, unless the 11 o'clock thing is right. Then you have to sleep in until 11:30.
And you have to sleep until 11:30. Actually, maybe we should just all sleep until 11:30 at noon, and then we'll all last longer. This is one of the other more unusual things that I've had to answer.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to let rest in peace? Just send it along any time of day in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our number again is 800-462-7413. Let's see now, Zorba, if we can help a listener in Stephenville, Texas. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
My question pertains to a problem that I've been having with my hands.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last couple of years, my hands, when they are exposed to water, the palms of them, within just minutes, start to wrinkle up as if they've been submerged in water for hours.
Hmm.
And they turn almost white, and you can see the pores. Just looks almost as if they're full of water to me. So I started researching this, and I looked online, and the closest thing I find pictures of what's called aquagenetic wrinkling of the palms. Except what that is, it says it's found in mostly cystic fibrosis patients.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm 33, and I do not have cystic fibrosis.
Oh, yeah, and you would know by now.
That's what I assume based on what I've read.
Right. But there is a difference in hands, in legs, in feet. I just want to ask you, are you or anyone in your family more prone to wrinkles, facial wrinkles?
Not that I've noticed so far, no.
Well, it's something you would tend to notice because people then look older before their time and because they're just more prone to facial wrinkles. And there are a genetic abnormality, so you don't have, if you will, the tensile strength of the keratin that is in your hand or in your palm. And so when any of us are in water for a period of time, we get wrinkles because the keratin gets weaker when it gets hydrated and then gets stronger when it dries out. How much does this bother you?
Well, it gets very painful. Within 5 minutes of me taking a shower or anything, it hurts. I can't hardly do anything. They get very, very sensitive.
And then how long does that last?
So after I get out for probably about 10 or 15 minutes, then it goes away.
Okay, so very, very typically what would last with other wrinkling. Well, when did you first notice this? How old were you?
About 30.
Mm-hmm. About 30. So with something
that came, 30.
Any medicines you put on it, medicated creams at all?
No, I'm afraid to put anything on there because it is so sensitive when it's wet. I'm worried, and I don't know if it's anything I need to be concerned about.
Well, I don't think I would be concerned about it. I don't. The real issue is the pain and the discomfort from this. So obviously, when you take a shower, you don't lounge in the shower. You take a shower, and you're in and out.
Yes, very quickly.
Very quickly. Do you ever take baths at all?
Yes, but it's got to be the same thing. I got to get real in there and out real quickly.
So it is the same thing. I don't have a good answer for this. Sometimes anti-inflammatory creams, steroid creams such as Kenalog, that's the name brand of a common generic cream, K-E-N-A-L-O-G, Kenalog cream, that might help you. But I don't know what would increase what we call the tensile strength of the keratin exactly for it. I think you've done the right thing. You wash your dishes with gloves. Is that correct?
Yeah, I even went so far, I go through times where I'll just wear latex gloves in the shower.
Right, no, but that may be so you can stay in the shower longer. So
it does. It allows me to stay in just a little bit longer. But, you know, the one thing I noticed that was very strange, last year I went to Mexico, and when I was in the salt water of the ocean, it took a lot longer for it to wrinkle up.
Oh, maybe a difference in hydration. That means if you put salt in your bathtub, you may notice the same thing. It might be soothing. Of course, you know, you might want to shower before you get out, but it may not be that salty, and you may be able to do that. What's it like to shower with gloves on?
I don't like it. It's hard to wash my hair.
That's what I would think. Well, good luck to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Interesting. Before we leave for the week, you have to deal with another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc, Zorba. Our recent definition of allspice has gotten a few listeners all worked up. You said it was a mixture of spices. But Bruce in Boulder Junction, Wisconsin, wants to set us straight. He writes, "Hey, gents, it's time for you to correct a little misinformation. During a recent recipe segment, you suggested that allspice was a blend of many spices. Wrong. Allspice is a single plant called the Pimenta dioica. It's native to the Caribbean, but is grown in many tropical areas."
So does that mean if I go into a spice shop and I ask for pimenta dioica, they'll know what I'm saying?
No.
No. I'll still have to say allspice.
But if allspice really isn't a mixture of spices.
Yes, then it's pimenta dioica. Dioica. Sounds almost like Japanese, doesn't it?
It dioica. Does, yeah.
Pimenta
dioica.
It's
from the Caribbean.
And it's, I don't think it's Japanese. Yeah. Well, once again, I've learned something from our loyal listener. Keep teaching me. Keep educating me. I love it.
He says that, but what he means is quit being so picky. If you think Zorba's advice is all mixed up, just send your rebuttal to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We'll see you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor and Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show is produced by Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping that you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1215Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.